I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. The race for the Republican presidential nomination looked all but done on Monday night, but oh, what a difference a day makes. Rick Santorum, the former U.S. Senator from Pennsylvania, went 3-for-3 on Tuesday, winning contests in Minnesota, Colorado, and Missouri. Does that put a speed bump or a boulder in the path of former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney, who was talking as though he had his party's nomination pretty much under control earlier this week? But that's just one of the topics in the news we'd like to talk about today. We're not just interested in who's up and who's down in the race for the White House, but also how to pay for the race. Of course, we're talking about super PACs and what impact they're having on the race. We're also interested in the controversy over the decision by the Komen Foundation, now reversed, to stop making grants to Planned Parenthood. And we're interested in whether the Obama administration might reverse itself over its proposed regulations that would require most institutions that serve the public, like hospitals and universities, to cover contraception in their health care plans. To talk about all of these stories, we've called upon Viviana Hurtado. She is blogger-in-chief of the website, The Wise Latina Club. Michelle Bernard is an independent. She's the president and CEO of the independent conservative think tank, the Bernard Center for Women, Politics, and Public Policy. Mary Kay Carey is also with us once again. She's a former speechwriter for President George H.W. Bush, and she's also a columnist and blogger for U.S. News and World Report. Welcome to all of you. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us, Michelle. Yeah.
Let's start off with the big news from last night. Here it is.
Thank you all so very, very much. It is great to be here. I just can't thank the people of Missouri. We doubled him up here and in Minnesota.
Mary Kay, of course, that's Rick Santorum.
That's him.
Former senator from Pennsylvania. In fact, I'm looking back over some conversations about politics that we've had in recent weeks, and we didn't even mention him.
Yeah, which he's been off the radar.
Which I'm sad about now. What happened?
Well, big clean sweep for him last night. It'll help him in terms of making the argument that he's more electable now. It certainly helped him with money. He raised $250,000 online last night alone, which probably doubled his entire war chest because I don't think he had much going into it.
More sweater vests.
Yes, more sweater
Fresh
vests. He went to the town that makes the sweater vests, which I thought was kind of sweet.
Excellent. Anyway, but did he send us any?
No.
We believe in clothing items that mark the important occasions. Okay, but tell me why. What do you think happened here? And this has been a very topsy-turvy race for those who recall.
That's the thing.
I mean, obviously, it's been, in the first three contests, three different people, at the top. But again, Rick Santorum did not seem to be making any headway. So what do you think happened here?
I think it was a question of turnout. One of the things that didn't get mentioned too much last night, I was watching Wolf Blitzer. He was just hyperventilating. He was so excited that this was not just a march to coronation, And I think that's very common in all the press. They love this conflict, the topsy-turvy, selling a lot in newspapers and getting people to tune in.
And blogs.
They were all non-binding last night. They're beauty contests, as we call them in politics. Not a single delegate was actually won last night. And I think that explains why turnout was low. I think it explains why some of these campaigns didn't put a whole lot of time and energy into it. And so I think that played to Rick Santorum's advantage. And so I think Mitt Romney was actually pretty lucky in all of this, because if you're going to have three losses in one night, he didn't lose a single delegate. So I think he's still the front runner by a big factor in terms of the delegate count. And I think it's more of a speed bump than a boulder, as you were saying earlier.
Just to clarify what you're saying, that these are beauty contests in the sense that these people, whatever they say at the polls last night, they are not bound by this at the nominating convention.
They can vote for anybody they want to.
For whoever they want, which is not the case in, say, Florida, which is you are bound unless your candidate releases you.
Get released after the first ballot.
Right. So, Michelle Bernard, interested in your take on what happened. And because you are an independent, and independents are highly sought after, you do lean conservative, obviously. But as we said, but independents highly sought after here. So I'm interested in first your analysis of what happened. And secondly, what about Rick Santorum's electability argument that he's the more electable candidate, that many people are saying that the Obama administration should be doing a happy dance because he's exactly the opposite. So I want to hear your perspective.
It's interesting. From my perspective, I think that this this is more of a speed bump for Mitt Romney than it might not be a boulder, but I do think it is more. I think it's a little bit more than a speed bump for him. Fascinating. No delegates were divided up last night, but if you look at who went out and vote last night, these are the tried and true Republicans, real conservatives, people, you know, where this democracy really makes a difference to them. Two out of the three states were caucuses. People had to go out and caucus for their candidate, and what it shows me, at least, is that for people who self-identify as true quote unquote conservatives, Mitt Romney is not their man. They overwhelmingly picked Senator Santorum. We saw that in Iowa also, and it also tells us that money doesn't really matter. I mean, Rick Santorum does not have the coffers of Mitt Romney. If you were really to look at it in terms of super PACs and who has the most money going into each race, Mitt Romney should have won this. By all accounts, I think this is a problem for him, mm-hmm. because what we continue to see is that for self-identified conservatives, people are saying anyone but Mitt Romney, and I think that the anyone but Mitt Romney does not help his campaign with independents either.
Viviana, your perspective, and then I do really want to ask somebody about the electability argument.
Yeah, and I'm going to build on what Michelle and what Mary Kate said. I think that. Even though it's a beauty contest and it's non-binding, it keeps the chatter going, the doubts about Mitt Romney and how truly conservative he is and if he could really win over the evangelical vote. For example, a significantly important part of the Republican primary voters, as well as bringing up, chatter about how flip-floppy he is. I think one thing that's really interesting about Rick Santorum is that he's had remarkable debate performances in the ones that I've viewed, certainly the ones in Florida and in South Carolina. He's been aggressive when he had to be. He's been going after Barack Obama when he had to, but he also did a good job of going after Mitt Romney on the issues of so-called flip-flopping, like women's reproductive rights as well as health care as he says, Obama/Romney care. I think what's also interesting, too, building on what the lady said, is that they're really we can't really underestimate the power of the underdog and how it is that a campaign that maybe is bare bones. Look, he's going to have to need the money. But I remember in 2008, we were talking about another underdog candidate who didn't seem to have the money of the so-called machine candidate, and he's the president of the United States.
Let's talk about a little bit more, a couple of the things you raised, including this argument about Rick Santorum's position and whether this is contributing to his position. A very strong candidate in support of or opposing, let's say, reproductive rights for women or, in his view, pro-life. This is how very strong pro-life candidate. So let's talk a little bit about that. And if you're just joining us, we're having an extended political chat this morning because there's a lot to talk about with Viviana Hurtado of the Wise Latina Club, Mary Kate Carey, columnist and blogger with U.S. News and World Report, also a former Republican presidential speechwriter, and Michelle Bernard of the Bernard Center for Women, Politics, and Public Policy. That's a right-of-center independent think tank. Let's hear from Rick Santorum one more time here. Last night during his victory speech, he talked about this ongoing controversy between some religious leaders, that Catholic bishops have taken the lead here, and the Obama administration, because the White House has issued regulations, proposed regulations that say that institutions like hospitals, universities, and colleges that serve the public, by and large, would be expected to cover contraception as part of the health care plans for their employees. And as we said, this is not just exclusively Catholics, but Catholic bishops have taken the lead in opposing this. And this is Rick Santorum, has been talking about this on the campaign trail. And let's play that clip.
When government gives you rights, the government can tell you how to exercise those rights. And we saw that with a group of people, a small group of people, just Catholics in the United States of America, who were told, you have a right to health care, but you will have the health care that we tell you.
Mary Kate, you are working on a piece about this, and you're saying that this is a perfect wedge issue that could try to peel some people who might otherwise be attracted to the president away from him in the fall. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, way of background, the exemption that we're talking about here has been limited by the administration that you could go under the conscience clause, as it's called, for health care. It used to be all churches and church-related institutions. The administration has narrowed it so that only churches themselves can get the exemption and not have to offer not just contraceptives, but the morning after pill, which is really what the hot button is here, because most Catholics consider the morning after pill to be abortion. And so now you can you have three choices. If you're a major Catholic institution, you can either go against your beliefs and offer morning after pills free of charge to your people under your healthcare plan. Or you can stop the healthcare plan, don't offer any insurance to your employees, and then face fines to the tune of $2,000 per employee. Catholic Charities, for example, nationally employs 70,000 people. That would be $140 million in fines, and their operating budget annually is only $40 million. So clearly that would bankrupt Catholic Charities, and you think about all the people that they help would no longer get their help. And then the third option would be to get under the exemption by only hiring and serving Catholics, as the strict definition of the church would be, which means all these Catholic colleges and hospitals and things like that would have to turn away non-Catholics as students and as patients and clients, whatever. So it's an untenable situation for these leaders of the Catholic institutions. The reason that I think it's a wedge issue is because...
But can I, let me just clarify one point here, and I only have a minute left. We're going to take a break, but we'll come back. The fact is, though, that this is the law in, what, something like 22, 28 states already. And somehow or another, accommodation, these institutions have accommodated themselves to that. So that's why people who say nationalizing the mandate isn't exactly what shouldn't be the big drama that it's being made out to be. Just
I think it's because it got to a national level that's why I think everybody fully expects it to go to the Supreme Court. And so anyway, the reason that I think this is going to unify the Republican field is because it brings together everybody who thought this about the Obama administration. It confirms everybody's worst suspicions in terms of big brother, big government, anti-religion, anti-First Amendment. All the people who have been worried about this sort of thing are all going to come together on the right.
As I said, we can come back to this in a minute, but we need to take a short break now. With us in Washington, D.C. are Mary Kate Carey, that's who was speaking just now, columnist and blogger for U.S. News and World Report. Also with us, Michelle Bernard, president and CEO of the independent conservative think tank, the Bernard Center for Women, Politics, and Public Policy, and Viviana Hurtado, blogger-in-chief at the website The Wise Latina Club. We're going to take a short break and come right back. Please stay with us on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, there's a new television program aimed at showcasing stories of missing people of color with the hope of getting the public to offer information to help solve these cases. And you might be wondering, why is there a need for a show like this? So we've asked the people involved with it, including the famous actress from Law and Order, S. Epatha Merkerson, to tell us more about it in a few minutes. That's coming up. But first, we are going to continue our conversation about politics and more in the news. Still with us, Mary Kate Carey of U.S. News and World Report, Michelle Bernard of the Bernard Center for Women, Politics, and Public Policy, and Viviana Hurtado of the Wise Latina Club. Mary Kate, before we took a break, you were making a point about the issue involving something that Rick Santorum had been talking a lot on the campaign trail.
Yeah.
And also former House Speaker Newt Gingrich had been talking about this before it kind of burst onto the front pages again. Just sort of finish your thought about that, if you would.
Yeah, it's bigger than a fight about contraception. It's bigger than a fight about the Catholic Church, because it galvanizes leaders from all other religions who think, what if we're next? It galvanizes Catholic swing voters in some of these key states, especially as we head into Super Tuesday. And Pew came out in the last week or two with numbers showing that since Obama took office, people who give themselves a religious affiliation are moving to the Republican column, including Jewish people, which is huge. It used to be a core Democratic constituency. So there's a lot of shifting sands here as we head into Super Tuesday.
Michelle?
one of the core questions that we ask ourselves going into the primary, into the general election is the election going to be decided on economics or demographics? And conventional wisdom has been it's been economics. When you look at this issue as well as other issues that are happening, mm-hmm. you start to think, you know what? I don't know. It could be demographics. And the Catholic voting bloc is a very important voting bloc. They are swing voters. You saw, for example, a lot of Catholics who were quote-unquote Reagan Democrats. The Catholic vote was particularly important to President Obama in the 2008 election. And so in terms of policy and its connection to the next election, he's dancing on a very, very thin tightrope here.
But it's also true, and we're going to talk about this later. We're going to talk about super PACs first, but we also want to talk about this issue later around how the pro-choice public does assert itself, too. I mean, often so much the energy and intensity seems to be on the pro-life side or the people who oppose abortion rights. But recently, it seems as though people who support a more expansive view of reproductive rights are asserting themselves. So I'm going to give you the last word on this question. You know, and there's also been reporting that the president, you know, that there are Catholics in his administration who said this is a bad road to go down. The exemption needs to be brought. And it's been reported that there are women in the administration, including Catholic women, who said if you give a broad exemption, you're leaving too many people out of coverage that they need and should have who are of diverse religious backgrounds. So, Vivian, I'm going to give you the last word. And how do you think this cuts?
I think what's going to be really interesting is exactly, is it going to end up, how heavy is this demographic weight going to, is going to have going forward? And I think that as I think about the Latino vote, which historically has trended Democratic, I think this is the kind of issue that could really put the Latino vote into play, because the Latino profile also tends to be a little more socially conservative. Mm-hmm. At the same time, pregnancy rates, for example, among Latinas is incredibly high. And there's a very serious social problem going forward with that has serious economic and societal implications. I also just wanted to say, too, that the Catholic vote is not monolithic. There is a lot of diversity and variety within American Catholicism.
That's a good point, an important point. And now we're going to talk about politics and money, and specifically how to pay for all this campaigning that we have been talking about. A lot of talk about super PACs. And to this point, we've been talking about how they have kind of fueled former House Speaker Newt Gingrich's presence in the race and his ability to stay in the race. We've also talked about Mitt Romney's primary run and how it's allowed him to kind of level some serious charges against Newt Gingrich and kind of really, you know, drop some big, you know, rhetorical bombs on him. Now the news is that President Obama, who had been a big critic of super PACs and the unlimited amounts of cash that people can give to them, his team is now endorsing a super PAC to support the president's reelection campaign. Jim Messina is the president's campaign manager, and he said in an interview, "We're not going to fight this one with one hand tied behind our backs." So is this hypocrisy or just common sense? To have this part of the conversation, we're going to welcome another voice to the table. That's Anna Marie Cox. She is the founder of the politics blog Wonkette, but now she's writing about U.S. politics for the British newspaper The Guardian. Anna Marie, thank you for joining us.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, hypocrisy or just common sense?
It can kind of be both, I think. I think in some cases, hypocrisy is common sense. I mean, hypocrisy is what happens when you have a belief system that tells you one thing, but the practical realities on the ground tell you another thing. And I think the president had a lot in common with a lot of Democrats on this issue, and maybe even some Republicans, in the sense that people can see how damaging this super PAC money is to the national conversation that we're having. But, you know, if you don't do it, it will be difficult to compete. And it would be nice to be able to take the moral high ground here. But I think that it's true that the president would probably lose. Now, would it be an honorable loss? Perhaps so. But there are things that I think a lot of people believe in that even more than campaign finance reform, like, for instance, access to birth control. And so if you want an administration that stands up for those beliefs, you might have to compromise on campaign finance reform. I do hope somehow that this hypocrisy does draw attention to the issue. We as a nation do not pay attention to campaign finance reform very much until the elections happen. But it's obviously something that's important year-round. And other civilized countries have federally funded elections, and it seems to work out pretty well. So maybe someday we'll think about those.
I'm stuck on that phrase, honorable loss, that you just used. Who believes in that?
Exactly.
When I first started covering politics as like a little baby reporter, and I remember one of the state delegates who tasked himself with schooling me about these matters, he says, you know what? Better be a live dog than a dead lion.
You know? Sure.
I'm going to ask my bloggers here, do voters care about this? I mean, Anna Marie made the point that people tend to pick their heads up in an election year and be interested, but by then it's too late because the rules are in place. So, Vivian, do people care about this stuff?
The blogosphere, my Facebook page, my Twitter page, is all about connectivity and about so-called being authentic. And I think what I feel is a real big bummer, even more than the hypocrisy. It's a bummer because I remember watching the State of the Union when President Obama looked at the Supreme Court justices and said, you know, there is no place in American politics for loads of money, something to that effect. And, you know, he was clearly, you know, swiping them for the citizens' decision. But the reality is, Anna Marie said, is that there is so much the footprint of money in politics is such that to think that we can turn back the clock is just completely unrealistic. We saw the results of that in Florida. Romney and his affiliated super PACs outspent Gingrich by so much, and the results were he won by a huge margin.
Mayor Kay, I'm going to give you the last word on this question, but I'm also going to quote Chuck D here, which is, don't hate the player, hate the game.
I'm with you.
Mary Kate, is you or not? Do you folks care about this? Do voters really care about it? And I'm saying just to the degree you can, take partisanship out of it. Because obviously if you're Republican, anything that makes the president look bad, you're happy.
Of course.
If you're,
Think that he says one thing and does another. And Anna Marie was pointing to maybe someday we'll have federal financing of elections. Well, we did have federal spending limits. And Barack Obama in 2008 was the first candidate ever to reject federal spending limits by rejecting government election public financing.
Matching funds.
Yeah, public financing. And so that was the most expensive presidential race ever. He spent $740 million alone. McCain, who agreed to the limits, only spent $227 million. So McCain was outspent 4-1 by Obama with all private funds. So for Obama now, presumably he's going to do the same thing, reject the limits again this year. Plus he'll have the super PAC money on top of that. To think that he's not going to win because of money is completely absurd. He's got plenty of money, and he doesn't think that the rules should have to apply to him.
But in high-profile races, money is not where it makes a difference. The issue is lower visibility races, right? I mean, this whole thing where—
I think that's right. I mean, look at Santorum.
It's not like we don't know who's running.
He's got no money.
Exactly. Yeah. So there you go. All right, let's switch gears now before we go and talk about this issue that's been very much in the headlines. And I think there's a debate about whether this is really about politics or not. So I just want to say I'm not taking a position here. I know that we call this a political chat, but this is the question before you. Is this about politics or not? And that is this whole question around the famous breast cancer charity, the Susan G. Komen for the Cure, took a lot of heat, saying that they would cut grants to Planned Parenthood. And it's a question of why, they said. They said different things about why they would cut these grants. They said, well, in part, they said it was because they were under investigation. Others said it was because they were not a direct provider of mammograms, that they were a referring agency, that if a woman came in who needed this service, they would refer you to a place, but they didn't provide that service itself. So after a lot of public pressure, they reversed themselves, and the executive director then, Karen Handel, resigned as vice president of that organization. So before we let you go, I'd like to ask each of you what you think this was about. And I apologize for my poor encapsulation of the facts, but they're all on your blog anyway. So tell me, so Anna Marie, I'll ask you, what do you think this whole controversy was about?
Well, it's inherently political, let's say. I mean, I think there's a lot to the slogan from the 70s, that the personal is political. And when it comes to women's bodies, I mean, they've been politicized basically since, you know, people figured out that women were the ones that had children. I think that, you know, the Planned Parenthood created this rule about not giving money to groups that are under investigation. Specifically, the only group that they funded that was under any kind of investigation was Planned Parenthood. So this rule was invented in order to give them cover to defund Planned Parenthood. So I find that political. I think that their, you know, decision to go back from that was political. I mean, it's political, and it's too bad. Because, I mean, it would be nice if we could say that women's bodies weren't politicized. But that's a future thing.
Just to clarify for folks, the investigation that we're referring to is an investigation by the Congress.
Republicans.
By Republican congressmen led by Cliff Stearns, who was following up on some undercover videos by this kind of sting, I don't know what you want to call her, journalist activist who is anti-abortion, who is anti-reproductive choice, and who seems to have caught Planned Parenthood staffers engaging in some not being as aggressive as she should have been in addressing a young woman who seemed to be underage. And so some behavior that triggered the investigation. So, Mary Kate, what do you think this is about?
Well, I thought the second explanation they put forward of many was better, which was that it didn't sound to me like Planned Parenthood is actually giving any mammograms. They just give referrals. So that would make sense to me why you would stop funding that if they weren't actually advancing the cause of, you know, early detection. But I think that they were naive, the Komen people were, to think that everybody else in town, if you gave them a grant and then said, oh, I'm sorry, no more funding, they say, well, thanks for what you've done for us in the past. Instead, Planned Parenthood mobilized social media, really went on a witch hunt for this vice president that they got ousted. I mean, really reacted. And I think that totally took the Komen people by surprise. I think it really tarnished their brand. I thought they had a gold-plated brand in town.
But the question I'm asking you is this about
that, actually.
Okay, Viviana, go ahead.
I would only disagree because at least among the women that I know, some of them being breast cancer survivors, there has been a lot of criticism about the Komen Foundation for spending a lot of money on high administrative costs.
There's a lot of that. You're right about that.
And, you know, so yeah. I guess there's been some controversy, but certainly not to this level, Mary-Kate, around Komen. The only thing I wanted to say was that what's really interesting about this, and Mary-Kate started touching upon this, was how all of this came to be and the reversal, the development of it, because of the pressure coming in the social space, in the blogosphere as well as social media. And what's really incredible about that is that in the span of about 2 or 3 weeks, we've seen an incredible rectification, so to speak, when there's been an overreach of powers. We saw that with the piracy bills that were working their way through Congress and how it is that the blogosphere erupted and said, hey, look, we need to put a stop to this right now because of ABC concerns around internet privacy
and
piracy.
But does it suggest
and so
that
forth.
More pro-choice people are on using social media than pro-life people, and that's why, or is it because Planned Parenthood struck first?
Because pro-life
people are on social media too.
The pro-life groups organized as well on Twitter and Facebook.
Michelle, I'm going to give you the last word on this.
I mean, I don't know completely what this was about, but I have to say I'm not picking sides, but what the Komen Foundation has done for breast cancer awareness, particularly in communities of color and in underserved communities, has really been pretty. It's really been very amazing. You don't see a lot of people doing what Komen does, and Planned Parenthood has put not only Komen, but I think other funders across the country in the position where they say, maybe we're not going to fund you in the future because one day when we decide we're not going to grant, you know, we're going to discontinue grant making to this organization, that you're going to hold us hostage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think they have put prospective funders in a very difficult position.
Yeah.
So Taya Bonarth, though, I know you're not taking sides in this, but do you think? What do you think this episode shows? I mean, Mary-Kate talked about just kind of the naivete she called on the part of the Komen folks about public relations 101, you might add, or crisis communications planning.
Yeah.
But what do you think it's about?
What I will say is that image, you know, image really counts. And if you're from, you know, Jupiter and you're taking a look at this, what you might be seeing is if you are a grant maker and you decide that you're going to stop funding an organization that provides abortion services, that all of a sudden, you know, public opinion is going to turn against you. The tide will turn against you. And all of a sudden you have a black mark on a very good brand and an important brand and for people who have done very, very important work in a different area. And I think that is a problem.
Well, it's a complex issue, and hopefully we'll something tells me we'll be talking about this again. So, Michelle Bernard is president and CEO of the independent conservative think tank, the Bernard Center for Women, Politics, and Public Policy. That's who you heard just now. Viviana Hurtado was also with us. She's blogger-in-chief of the website The Wise Latina Club. And Mary Carey is also here with us. She's a columnist and blogger for U.S. News and World Report. She's also a former presidential speechwriter for President George H.W. Bush. They were all here in Washington, D.C. with us. And with us from Tampa, Florida, member station WUSF, Anna Marie Cox. She's the founding blogger at Wonkette, the blog site. She is now a columnist for the British newspaper The Guardian. Ladies, thank you all so much.
Great to be here.
Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, you heard him talk about his hilarious new memoir earlier this week. Now find out what tunes author and comedian Baratunde Thurston is listening to these days. That is later in the program. But first, we want to take some time to pay attention to a topic that some people think has been neglected by the news media: missing people of color. African Americans alone are around 13% of the population, but according to the FBI, African Americans accounted for more than 30% of the missing person reports filed in 2010. But I think it's fair to say that that is not something you would know, judging from many news reports. Now, critics have started to ask why cases involving people of color don't seem to get as much attention as those involving white victims, particularly white females. And they're also asking whether this relative neglect plays a role in the ability or perhaps interest of law enforcement in solving these cases. But now there's a new television series that's trying to go beyond the media critique to actually help solve some of these open cases. Find Our Missing is a 10-part series that debuted in January on TV One. The show profiles open cases of African Americans who are missing. Here's a short clip.
This is a victim. This is someone's sister. This is someone's child. This is someone's loved one.
I never thought I wouldn't see her again. That never crossed my mind.
Fear of not knowing. That's almost indescribable to me.
Joining us to talk more about Find Our Missing is the host, S. Epatha Merkerson. She is an award-winning actor. She's perhaps best known for her long-running role as Police Lieutenant Anita Van Buren on NBC's Law and Order. She's with us now. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining us is Derica Wilson. She is the president of the Black and Missing Foundation. That's a nonprofit that works to bring attention to missing African Americans. The organization collaborated with TV One to bring about the Find Our Missing series. She's also with us. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I should say joining us once again, because we previously spoke with you on this program about your efforts to start this foundation. And I'd want to mention you are a former police officer. You're actually currently still a police investigator, so it's Officer Wilson. And you found this organization because?
Well, back in the days, I'm from Spartanburg, South Carolina, and there was a young lady that went missing by the name of Tamika Houston, and her family struggled to get media coverage. And months later, Natalie Holloway disappeared, and she was dominating local and national news. And after doing some research, we found that there was a lot of persons of color missing that were not getting the awareness.
What difference does it make, and particularly drawing upon your experience as an officer yourself, what difference does that media coverage make? A lot of people would say, well, so what? That's a separate issue. Investigating what the police are doing, what law enforcement is doing, and what the media is doing are two different things.
Media coverage is very vital in the safe recovery of missing persons. We all know that time is of the essence, and if we can put out that profile of this missing person, the chances of a reunion with their family members are greater.
What does it do, though? Is it just brings in more information? What does it put the heat on law enforcement, to put it bluntly? What does it do?
Absolutely, it does. It put the heat on law enforcement to be more proactive, to utilize other resources to find these missing persons.
Epatha, why did you want to be involved in this? As we know, you're a very accomplished actor, and clearly there are lots of projects that you could turn your hand to. What made you want to get involved?
Well, I had been hearing this dialogue that was happening on the radio about people of color who were missing. And shortly after that realization, I got a call from TV One asking me would I host the show. And it just felt like a no-brainer. And as I started reading some of the cases, then I felt like I was being a part of a community in need, of our community in need.
Is there a sense, though, that the identification of you as Police Lieutenant Anita Van Buren, a very popular role? In fact, I think your role was historic, and I think you were the longest-running African-American character on network television.
Primetime. Well, and I think absolutely it had something to do with why they asked. I think that my job on this show is really to put a face to what we are now calling the call to action, which happens at the end of the show. It puts a face on it. It allows people to see someone that they trusted on television. They trusted my characterization of Van Buren. And so, yeah, I think it does help having a face to bring people in.
The format is similar to America's Most Wanted, if people remember that program. There are reenactments. There are interviews with family members and friends and people who might have relevant information. It's interesting that the series, it's only been on for a couple of weeks, but it's already been noted for the high production value. I'm wondering if you think that that matters. I mean, the information clearly is important. That's what you want to get out there. But the fact that it's well produced, do you think that that's important?
Absolutely, because the best way to tell the story is in the production of it, is to tell a clear story. And what I love about the production is that it takes you to the actual place where the person went missing. It starts there. You have the visual in front of you, which is, to me, a production value that is invaluable.
We're talking with Esipaitha Merkerson. She's the award-winning actress, and she is host of the new TV One docudrama series, Find Our Missing. The purpose of the series is to document and hopefully gather information about African-American people who have been the subject of missing persons reports. Also with us is Derica Wilson. She is the president of the Black and Missing Foundation. She's also a former police officer and is now a current police investigator who started this foundation in order to draw more attention to the cases of African-Americans who have been missing. The program, it doesn't sugarcoat the fact that there are some choices, lifestyle choices involved in some of these cases. Like, for example, there was one case that was profiled in the series where the children were evidently abducted but were left alone by the parent. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested in, you know, your take on that.
Well, there are lifestyle choices, but this right here could be a distraction. At the end of the day, this person is missing, and we don't want to focus on the lifestyle choices that the people make. We want to focus on the fact that this person is missing.
Well, but one of the stories profiled points out the fact that no one in the family called the police for hours. They were out in the streets searching for the children themselves. But the program speculates that maybe one of the reasons they didn't call the police is that they were afraid that they would be judged for the fact that the children were home alone.
Well, but that could be the case. And also, what about the fact that so many people think that there is a waiting period in contacting law enforcement? You know, some people think that you have to wait 24 hours before you can call the police when it's a child, it's immediately. Mm-hmm. And understanding the laws in your state, for example, in Washington, D.C., as well as in Illinois, if it's an adult missing, you can call immediately. So I think people need to understand the laws in their state.
Go ahead, Esipaitha.
I just want to say, if I may speak for the producers, I think that it was intentional that they tell the story honestly. And they've taken these stories directly from the local law enforcement. So they're getting every bit and piece of this story to present it to the public. And I think that there's a twofold reason to let folks know exactly how these things can happen in families, but also as a learning tool. So these are things that you should be aware of as well in your family, with your children, with your loved ones. So it's kind of twofold, I think.
How were the cases selected? Does either of you know?
Well, they wanted to go from all walks of life. And what we want people to understand is that it doesn't matter if you live in the rural area, the suburbs, it can happen to anyone, anywhere, at any time. So they wanted to go through all walks of life of selecting people that are missing just to show.
I mean, I was interested in that because one of the implied criticism of the series, and in your case, Derica, it's an explicit criticism, is that the news media cherry picks cases. It cherry picks people who they think will be of interest. And for whatever reason, it tends to be attractive white women and cute kids. And I don't, Esipaitha, do you mind if I ask you, why do you think that is? I mean, I know you're not a journalist, but you've been around it for a long time. Why do you think that is?
You know, we can charge racism. We can charge apathy. I really don't know why it is so, because these cases, when you start learning of the different lives of these people and the years they've been without information on their loved ones, it's so imperative that this information be given a national forum. I can't explain why that happens, other than that there is apathy about persons of color who are missing. And when people see this show, I think they will be moved to understand why this is so important, that these cases be given a national forum. One of the things I learned from Derica is that a lot of cases are involved with human trafficking. And so, indeed, a national forum is what's important, because someone who may have been missing in Chicago could be anywhere in this country and in this world, literally. You know, Derica certainly can speak on that.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about that. Do you feel that since you've started working with the Black and Missing Foundation, trying to bring attention to cases of missing persons who are not always covered by the national media and the local media, for that matter, there's been a lot more attention to human trafficking?
Yes.
And people making the connection between people being abducted and being put into this situation, which is a form of modern-day slavery. Do you feel that you're making headway in getting people to understand that this is not just a matter of, you know, a girl going off with her boyfriend and not wanting to call home?
Yes, I think we're making a lot of headway. At the same time, I feel that we still have a long way to go. We are on the right path. And just to reiterate the importance of just putting the information out there. For example, we actually just reunited a young lady, 11-year-old young lady with her family, who was in sex trafficking. Human trafficking.
You mean, wait, do you mean the foundation, or do you mean on the course of the television program?
The foundation.
The foundation.
The foundation.
Was able to.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What happened to the girl?
She was abducted, and she was actually getting ready to be sold off. And because of vigilant community activists coming forward, sharing the information out there, someone spotted that young lady and reported it.
Was she on the street? I mean, how was she abducted?
Outside playing.
She was outside playing.
Outside playing.
So it's like an Elizabeth Smart situation, who was abducted from her own bedroom. She was just outside her own neighborhood playing, and somebody took her off the
street.
Someone
has taken her. So one of the things that we really do encourage families to do is make sure that you are checking the sex offender registry frequently, where your kids go to school, where you live, where you work, because there are so many predators that are preying on our children. And these kids are disappearing at an alarming rate. I mean, 2,000 kids are reported missing daily. That's a lot of kids. How many Amber Alerts do you hear about these kids?
Derica, before we let you go, we'd like to ask, as we mentioned, that the series premiered just last month. Mm-hmm. So a couple of episodes have been aired. Do you feel that you've gotten any useful information as a result of airing the series?
Absolutely. We have received tips and since the series has aired. And when we receive those tips, we pass them on to law enforcement. One of the things that S.E. Patha states at the end of the show, you know, is everybody's responsibility. This is the call to action. She's sharing the phone number for our community to contact the police. But on our website, we have an anonymous tip line. And we understand that our community, there is a lack of trust. So they are coming to us providing those tips, and we're sharing those tips with law enforcement. At the end of the day, all we are wanting is reunions, closure, and justice for families.
Ipeitha, final thought from you?
Well, you know, I had the opportunity to meet Rose Starnes, who's the mother of Yasmin Akri, 15-year-old. I met Ayanna Patterson, who's the mother of Alexis Patterson, who's been missing for 10 years. And when you meet these families, you understand how important it is that anyone who has information on someone who's missing, how important it is for these families to be reunited with their loved ones and give these families some type of closure.
S.E. Patha Merkerson is the winner of an Emmy and a Golden Globe. She is now hosting Find Our Missing. It's a series on TV One that airs Wednesday evenings at 9. She was here with us from New York. Also with us, Derica Wilson. She is the president of the Black and Missing Foundation. That's a nonprofit that works to bring attention to missing African Americans. And she was kind enough to join us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Ladies, thank you both so much for your time.
Thank you for having us.
Now it's time for our occasional feature we call In Your Ear. That's where we ask some of our guests about what they're listening to these days. Today, we're going to hear some music that inspires author and comedian Baratunde Thurston. He was on our program this week talking about his new memoir, How to Be Black. Here are some of the songs he listens to.
Hello, I am Baratunde Thurston, author of How to Be Black. And here's what I'm listening to right now. A lot.
Smoking, I'm on fire, I am blazing, don't get hurt. To my wife, this is a concert, to my black nurse, this is church. First up, we have Sunrise by Childish Gambino, a.k.a. Donald Glover, from his latest album, Camp. This is just a hand clapper, knee slapper, really good way to wake up in the morning. I actually set my alarm to it. Number two is actually an entire album. It's by a band called Solfege that my friend Derek Ashong, who's actually featured in my book, has just put out. You can actually download for free, and it's this Afro-funkalicious, soulful R&B hip-hop melange of beauty.
Special happened today. I got green lights all the way.
And then number three is Aloe Black, BLACC, the guy who used to be a rapper and found his soul in soulful music, his song Green Lights. It's all about positivity, about those magic moments when you're driving and all the lights turn green and the world just seems to be going your way. It's something I happen to feel right now, and it's something I hope all of you are feeling more often.
I don't know what's yet to come. Not sure of anything that I've done. Really makes that much difference. Well, I hope it has for some.
That was author and comedian Baratunde Thurston telling us what's playing in his ear. And to hear our previous conversation with him, please go to our website. Go to npr.org. Click on the Programs tab and then on Tell Me More. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.
Well, I was driving over the moon,
oh, wow.
In my big hot air balloon.